I wished I had outsourced more of that, in essence, is what I'm saying. I felt like as the founder, I had to do all the hiring. But it turns out, as long as I did the last mile, you know, and I would thumbs up or thumbs down someone, it was plenty good. And so the funnel was filtered so much for me, you know, by the time we worked at LeadPages, I was like, nah, I shouldn't have been doing that top of funnel stuff in the hiring process.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
So this morning, we were deep into a program called Get Drip, and it's what we use for our automated email sequences. And I understand you had the founder of that gentleman, or that software as a service program on the podcast today. Is that right?
That's right. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with Rob Walling. He writes over at Software by Rob. He is the host over at Startups for the Rest of Us podcast. He's the founder or co-founder, I should say, of MicroConf, the SaaS conference. He is also the founder of Hittail, an SEO software. And of course, Drip Email Marketing Automation, one of the leading email marketing automation softwares out there, which was acquired by LeadPages a few years ago in an eight-figure acquisition. So really cool guy, tons of experience in a lot of different areas, especially in that startup environment. And, you know, Joe, you and I like to have these calls with people, these conversations with people where we try and like pull out a certain lesson or something else. I remember the episode with Mike Jackness and the crazy high open rates and returns that he gets on his Facebook marketing. I went into this without any specific agenda. I just wanted to talk to Rob about his story and kind of the adventure he's been on since he started up Drip and some of the other things as well, but we didn't get into much else because we just kind of talked about his journey with Drip, which was fascinating. You know, and one of the things to think about with Drip, they started off in a world where there was really big competitors. You had Infusionsoft, you had Klaviyo that was still big at the time, you had MailChimp, which was absolutely a monster, AWeber, which had been around forever. And here you have this little startup with no funding, just a handful of coders working out of basically a closet, as it were. And they ended up blowing up into one of the biggest email marketing automation softwares out there and being acquired for eight figures by LeadPages a few years later. And so we talked a lot about how they do it. How did they go through that? How does he hire people? We covered a lot of territory, but it was fascinating.
Well, I think you said founder maybe five or six times there. So I would think it would have to be fascinating when you're founding that many companies and that successful. So I don't think anybody wants to hear you and I talk about this anymore. Let's just go right to Rob.
Yeah, let's get to him. Rob, thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So you've listened to a couple of the episodes of the Quiet Light podcast. You know how we work. Why don't you give people a quick introduction as to who you are?
Yeah. So my name is Rob Walling, and I'm a serial software entrepreneur, probably most known for founding and selling Drip, which is email marketing or marketing automation software. I've also run a number of other SaaS apps, including Hittail, which is an SEO tool. I co-founded MicroConf, which is a conference for self-funded startups. And I have a couple podcasts. One's called Startups for the Rest of Us. And the idea there is to help people, give people an option in starting software and SaaS companies that's like, you don't need to raise funding to do it. And that podcast has been running since 2010. So we have like 400 some episodes. And my other one is called Zen Founder. It's with my wife, who's a psychologist. And we talk a lot about trying to stay sane while running a business.
Trying to stay sane while running a business, that's a pretty hard thing to be able to do.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So we have a lot that we could talk about here. I want to talk a little bit about just building and growing a SaaS business. But one thing I want to start off with here is you're kind of a member of the very old guard when it comes to internet entrepreneurs. You know, when I started in the online world, it was kind of expected that you do everything, right? You code, you market, you design, and you do everything top to bottom. And it's a lot harder to do that today. But you've been keeping up with that. So are you still actively doing a lot of the coding?
I am not. I backed away from it. I, you know, wrote software professionally for a paycheck from 2000 to about 2008. And I really enjoyed that time. And it basically gave me the leverage and a little bit of savings to be able to start acquiring businesses. You know, I mean, that's what a lot of people don't know is I've really only started a couple of software companies. I've bought way more than I, you know, products and websites and soft SaaS apps than I started. So, but around 2011, 2012, it just was no longer worth it for me to code. You know, my time is more valuable doing all the other stuff that pulling the big levers to move the business rather than sitting behind a terminal, even though I love it. I still write code on the weekends though, right? I hack away PHP scripts. I was scraping Twitter feeds and trying to do sentiment analysis. I was teaching myself Python. It's just fun to build things, you know, but I haven't pushed production code in probably 5 years.
Yeah, I used to code. I started to code out of necessity when I first was an entrepreneur. And first, I had no money. So I was like, I need to build this. I think I built a very basic pay-per-click search engine and kind of advertising platform. I did that in Perl of all things. And then, self-taught myself. And since then, I've missed doing it, but I just don't have the time to jump back in. Yeah. So the fact that you're doing it on the weekends, tip of the cap to you for sure. So let's talk a little bit about building and growing a SaaS company, because you've done it a couple of times, you've done it successfully. And maybe also, I didn't know that you were active in the buying world. So let's talk a little bit about that. And let's talk about what you look for when you are buying a SaaS company. Mm-hmm. And how do you go about some of those code challenges? So let's start with a basic question. Ballpark number, how many businesses would you say that you've bought over the last 5 or 6 years?
Let's go back a little further, because see, once I started Drip, which was 2012. So I bought zero in the last 6 years. But before then, from let's say 2005 was my first acquisition and 2011 was my last. So over that 6 year period, I probably purchased, I would say 25 or 30 different, they're either software products, SaaS, or even, I mean, I bought like, you know, half a dozen AdSense websites back in the day, right? So I really enjoyed it. I mean, the idea of being able to skip product market fit, not have to do all the hard work up front and have a revenue stream has always been attractive to me, especially as someone, I mean, when I was writing software, I was a contractor, I was billing 125 an hour, 150 an hour sometimes. And my time was super valuable. I was booked 40, 50 hours a week. And so it was like, wait, let me get this straight. I can, back then it was Flippa, right? I mean, it was before you guys, before, you know, Effie and other folks. And I would go on Flippa and pay 18 months, you know, of net profit. And sometimes I got totally hosed on it, right? Because mm-hmm. Flippa is can be a little bit dangerous. But the ones that worked were life-changing for me. You know, and by 2009, I was full-time just on products. So sorry, that was a long answer, but that's the value I see in acquiring over. I've told my wife, like, if I do this again, because I don't know if I'm going to do another one after Drip, it was just a lot of work. There's no chance I'm doing it from scratch. Zero chance that I will do something from scratch for the rest of my life. I will always acquire from that at this point on.
Wow. Obviously, we are big believers in that. I mean, that upfront product fit, like you said, and doing the hard work is difficult. When you started Drip, when did you start Drip?
We broke out on code in December of 2012, and then we launched in 2013.
Okay. And you were originally just sort of an add-on or a layer on top of existing software programs, right? So like AWeber and I think MailChimp was one of the main vehicles.
Yeah. That's right. We were just like a pop-up and autoresponders, but we also fed into MailChimp because we couldn't even send broadcast emails at the time.
Wow. All right. So then you layered on top of that. And did you always have in mind with Drip that it was going to be an automation, the sort of kind of logic sequence?
No, we didn't. And in fact, we resisted it pretty heavily because I didn't want to get into the marketing automation. It's just a big, at least in my eyes at the time, it seemed like this big enterprisey, clunky, old, really hyper-competitive space with a bunch of funded competitors, just not a market I wanted to get into. I tend to like really tight niche markets where you can just own that thing and, you know, you don't have to, you're not fighting red water every day with someone else. It's not a feature race all the time. But it became clear about a year into running Drip, year and a half, that was where the whole space was going. And not building that would have just relegated us to been undifferentiated. We would have just had another Me Too product. And by building an automation and building it in a way that was more elegant, or, you know, at least I think so, more elegant, easier to use than the Infusionsofts and the ActiveCampaigns and the, you know, some of the other competitors, that's how we got on the radar. You know, I mean, we were an unfunded marketing automation platform in essence, right? We didn't raise any money, and we were five people basically in a closet in Fresno, California. And we were number 12 on Datanize's marketing automation list. Like, and all the 11 ahead of us had raised, deca millions. Some had raised nine figures. I mean, it was crazy.
Well, that's one of the things I find fascinating about your story. But like, when I first saw Drip kind of pop up, right, you had these really large players out there that you knew had significant revenues coming in, significant funding, very large programming teams of developers. How did you guys manage to stay agile like that? It's such a small footprint of a company, but still put out incredible code. What were some of the things? I mean, I'm asking you to go back here and kind of think back, but what were some of those things that you did to be able to compete against those larger players?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because Derek's my co-founder with Drip, and we are both software people, right? I've written code since I was a kid, so had he. And so we built the company. It was very much a product-focused company. You know, a lot of, you'll see MarTech companies launch and they're very marketing-focused and the software's kind of a piece of crap, you know? And then you'll see them get legacy over the years, and eventually they can't ship features, or they ship them very, very slowly. You do one or two releases a year. And for a SaaS app, that's just not the way you need to do it. So Derek and I, from day one, built a very strong foundation. It took 6 months to get Drip into people's hands. And it really, we could have done it in 3 months, but it would have been shitty code. And so we focused early on of not having legacy. We took our time to build a really solid foundation architecturally. And then the first three hires that I made were Derek, who was a contractor at the time and then became W2 and then eventually, you know, got shares and retroactively made him a co-founder. And then two other developers. So when we were a team of four, it was three developers and me, and I did everything else. And that allowed us, without the legacy, it allowed us to ship really fast. We were super agile. We used GitHub issues, and we would hammer out features. We would hammer out an entire integration in less than a day, because there was one dude who had built 35 integrations for us. And it was just this relentless focus. There were no meetings. There were no, if there was a question, we stood up at a whiteboard. You know, it's the luxury of A, being a small team, and B, being in person. And I know, you know, if I build a team again, it's going to be remote, but we move way faster because we were in person 2 to 3 days a week. And then we were all at our houses the other two or three. And it was this perfect blend of speed. I mean, our velocity, it's funny you call that out, because that so many people called out. And even, you know, Clay Collins, who's CEO of LeadPages, called that out earlier on. He's like, how are you, you're like five people. How are you shipping this many features? I mean, we were shipping multiple features a week, and it was just getting in there. Architecture was stable, and the developers, also we hired really good developers. You know, we focused very much on that. Derek and I being two developers, we were super rigorous and super picky about who we hired. And so there's a lot that goes into it. And, you know, I've kind of been rambling, but it was really this relentless focus on the product comes first, and the product is what we're going to be really good at. And at the same time, I have some regrets, you know, of like, I think I should have marketed harder early on. I think I should have hired a marketer that was better than me. I think that, you know, there were certain things now that I look back that it's like, maybe we focused on the product a little too much, but I don't know. In the end, I think it worked out.
Obviously it worked out. And this is kind of an interesting thing I've seen with software companies. I read a book by the founder of Zusk Dating, and they talked about their ability to push out code and features rapidly, right? It would be, you know, come up with an idea in the morning, push it out by mid-afternoon because they were able to do that. What sort of approval process did you guys have in place to be able to ensure that you weren't just getting all sorts of like conflicting features?
Mm-hmm. We had, both Derek and I knew every feature that was shipping. And we knew that until we hit, I mean, even, so I left Drip about 3 months ago. It was acquired by the LeadPages. You know, I think it's kind of the punchline to, so people know about that. And even when we were 10 or 12 engineers, Derek and I still knew everything that was shipping. And so it's just product management, you know. To be honest, when there's only three or four developers, you can keep it all in your head or on a whiteboard. You don't even need that much process. Now, as soon as you tip to four or five, then you need some type of Kanban, you know, or something. And then when we hit seven or eight, it was like, all right, we do need a weekly meeting now, 30-minute weekly meeting. But we had no standing meetings, none of that. I mean, it was like, you're writing code 100% of the time, or you're talking about writing code, you know. So we also had extensive unit test coverage. We had, I think, 3 lines of unit testing code, of unit tests for every line of production code. So it allowed, that allowed us the safety of like, pretty sure this isn't going to break anything because one of these tests would have caught it, you know, and then we do a sanity check on a server and push it. We, you know, knock on wood, we had very few over the five and a half year run, like, you know, production bugs that like really did some damage, you know, and we'd get little things here and there, but we only had maybe 2 that I can remember where it was like a scheduling issue where it's like, oh crap, we forgot to send emails for an hour. Like that's a big deal, you know, and that happened maybe once and there's some other stuff. So code quality was high and we focused on that.
So you mostly run your team local to some extent, but at some point when you started to grow and before the acquisition with Lead Pages, did you have a remote team?
We did, yeah. Yeah, so there were 10 of us total by the acquisition, and there were five of us in Fresno in an office. And like I said, we came in about 2 to 2.5 days a week to that office and worked from home the other days. And that was a great balance of there was enough time to whiteboard. There were enough days. Every other day, you were going to see some, you know, people and ask questions. But then you could go home and get a ton of work done, right? And then we had 5 people who were all over the place. Really, there was, we had a support guy in Mexico, and we had a, you know, developer in another part of California, and somebody in New York and stuff. So
wow,
it worked out.
And so given you said if you start something again here in the future, it'll probably be remote, even though you're not really convinced that's necessarily the better way to go about it. Why is that? Why would you choose remote in light of the fact that you might think it's not the best way to go?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the ideal way is that everybody can meet in a room, you know, a day or 2 a week. As I've said, that was the best working environment I've ever had. I would go remote because it's just so hard to find the right talent at the right price in any given metro area. You know, it's like you can go to Silicon Valley and yes, there's a lot of engineers, but damn, are they expensive? You know, or you can come to Minneapolis and they're going to be less expensive, but how many, you know, Ruby developers are actually here and how many are going to leave, you know, Target or Best Buy to come work for me? It's going to be tough. If I make it a nationwide search or even, you know, I tend to go 3 time zones in either direction, 3 hours in either direction from where I am. So I'll go north to south, right? I certainly hire in Canada or Mexico, Central South America. You can just find really good people who sometimes live out in the middle of nowhere. And if you're able to work with them remotely, man, they can ship some really, really good stuff for you.
Yeah. Hiring people is always a challenge. I don't think I've ever talked to an entrepreneur and business owner, and I'll throw myself in that ring as well. Hiring people, that's an absolute pain. Do you have any insights that you want to give?
Oh, as far my as gosh. We could do a whole episode on this. Yeah.
You really could do a whole episode on this. So yeah. We'll keep it a little bit short because I want to talk a little bit about MicroConf and also more of the history of Drip. But this is more for me. You know, listeners, you can mute this for a little bit. And
totally.
I want to pick your brain.
Totally. Yeah. No, some quick tips. One thing that Derek and I did was we hired a lot around personality. We really want, especially when we were small, it was like, I want to be able to hang around in a room with you 8 hours a day. A lot of companies I work at don't do that, or I've worked at don't do that. They really do hire based on skills and talent. And as a result, we passed over some pretty good developers, but we could just tell they were edgy or they were a little too opinionated, or, you know, there were just things. It was like, we were super, super careful. So we did hire slow. It meant our hiring process took a long time. We also presented it for what it was. Like the job postings were written very, almost like a blog post, or like it was very conversational. Oh, it was more like a sales letter. It would start the blog, my job descriptions would say, it was all you language. It was like, you're an excellent developer. The world is your oyster. You can go work at any company you want. But here's why you don't want to work at an agency, because the da-da-da-da-da, you know, you could go here, but come work for us. You can be fully remote. You can be, you know, and then I present the benefits. So it's very much like, you know, you'd imagine writing a sales letter where you present the you language and then you go down and present the problem and then we're the solution, like come work for us. So as a result, we got really high quality candidates. And it was a very, you know, I would say, look, we do not pay. Don't come here if you want to make what you're going to make at a Fortune 500 company. We do not pay that, you know, these exorbitant developer wages, but here's what you get in exchange. You know, you get the freedom to do this. There are no set working hours. You're fully remote. We're going to send you a MacBook Pro. We're going to buy you 2 Dell monitors. We're going to, you know, just all the stuff that some developers don't want that, right? They just want the maximum paycheck, and other developers loved it. There were people who came and said, I can't get this kind of flexibility anywhere else. So having, it's like, what is your differentiator, right? That's what we figured out early on. And we put it right from the start in the job description of like, you, this is either awesome for you or this sounds terrible. And then the last thing, I'll stop, is one thing that I learned once we went into lead pages, because our hiring process took a long time. It was 20, 30 hours a week for me at times. And once we got to lead pages, there were two in-house recruiters, just full-time recruiters, who were freaking phenomenal. And one thing that I would do if I were to do again is try to find someone like that on an hourly basis, and not a contingency recruiter, right, where they charge you 15% of the salary, but just find somebody on Upwork or whatever who's $50, $75 an hour, who I can train to do all this stuff. Or they can train me, frankly, because once we got the lead pages, like they had it down, right? I mean, they grew 50 people a year for a few years. So they had their process down. They taught me a ton of things that I wished I had outsourced more of that, in essence, is what I'm saying. I felt like as the founder, I had to do all the hiring. But it turns out, as long as I did the last mile, you know, and I would thumbs up or thumbs down someone, it was plenty good. And so the funnel was filtered so much for me, you know, by the time we worked at lead pages, I was like, nah, I shouldn't have been doing that top of funnel stuff in the hiring process.
Yeah, I can tell you, I just went through the process of hiring somebody on for Quiet Light Brokerage. And, you know, typically with Quiet Light, the people that come on and work with us, you know, they approach me about coming on as a broker. Well, we needed some work in the marketing side. And so I put out the job application. It's a full-time job, like going through and trying to, you know, vet these people. And, you know, you want to hire slowly, but you got a bunch of other stuff on your to-do list. It's outsourcing that, if you're able to do so, makes sense. And the tip that you gave as far as writing the job post in terms of you're the second business owner that I've talked to recently that has given that tip. And I think it's a phenomenal way to go about it. Instead of just saying, you know, we need this, we need that, this is what we need. Given the benefits that you attract that top talent is a good suggestion. Okay, let's talk. Go back again to Drip here. When did you realize that this was not just like a little project that you were going to have as like the super niche product and really something that could play with some of the big boys? I mean, now, you know, you guys would be direct competitors with a MailChimp and with an AWeber. And, you know, those guys have had to play catch up to you, frankly, in some ways, or to what you built. So when was that realization? What made you turn and say, okay, I'm going to go all in on this for a while?
Yeah, it was a very pivotal decision. And it was a hard one to make, as I said, because I've had a lot of lifestyle businesses and I value my lifestyle very highly. And it was a decision of, boy, am I going to continue to have a lifestyle business or am I going to scale up like a startup? You know, do I want to go all in on this? And I was talking with Derek about it too, but it was really a turning point for me. So we started doing our early access in mid 2013, and we launched to our launch list in November of 2013. And it took us until August of 2014 to hit product market fit. We were just struggling, you know, just adding. And it was when we added automations, the initial automation. It wasn't even the workflows that are all visual. It was just, you know, kind of almost like If This Then That or Zapier stuff. That was game changing because we started, you know, growing, I don't know, 20% month over month. We're flailing around a bit until June as we started rolling out automations. And then it was like, all right, now we're going 10%. Now we're going 15%. Now we're going 20%. And it was like, boy, this is becoming a thing. You know, we have built something that people really want. And we, at that point, we weren't ahead of, you know, Infusionsoft had their visual builder and ActiveCampaign did too. And I don't know, it was Klaviyo. I mean, there were competitors around. We weren't ahead of them, but we had just done an elegant job. You know, it was kind of like we had built a really easy to use platform like a MailChimp, and we had added automation to it in a way that really didn't exist quite in the same way. So that was when it was really towards the latter half there of 2014 that it was like, man, this thing's growing fast. And now we have to hire with the staff up. Like that was the realization.
Was that the point in time when you decided that possibly selling was on your radar?
No. Selling came on the radar in 2015, and we were staffing up. And I realized, Derek and I had a lot of conversations. It's like, we can't hire fast enough. Like, we don't have the money. You know, it's running Drip was, especially with the staffing, trying to keep up with everyone else, it was just an expensive thing. I mean, SaaS apps obviously have great margins, and we had a great gross margin, but our net margin was not very good because I kept hiring, you know, it'd grow 10 grand of MRR, and I'd go out and hire another developer every time because it was like, no, we have to keep up with all these competitors. So that was when I realized, you know, we either need to raise an angel round, like a seed round, probably $500,000, or we may want to think about, you know, answering one of these emails were getting to acquire us. So we got maybe five pretty serious inquiries. We got more than that that were just, you know, whatever. You get weekly funding offers, right, from a junior, you know, a junior rep at a VC firm. And every couple of months, we get an email of like, we'd like to acquire you. And then about five of them were people who, companies or funds who actually had the money to do it, you know? And that was when it was kind of like, all right, so what do we do? Do we take chips off the table, you know, cash out in essence, have a good outcome for us and the employees, or do we push more chips in, basically raise funding, you know, at a valuation? Because we probably would have raised funding similar to the valuation we're going to be acquired at. And that puts you in for 2, 3, 4, 5 more years of doing it. So it was a big decision process for us. And frankly, I was burning out a bit. I mean, I was struggling to run the company. I didn't, you know, delegate or outsource as much as I should have. Next time around, I would do a little differently for sure.
So how did you decide LeadPages was going to be the partner that you were going to work with? If you had five serious potential acquirers.
Yeah, LeadPages was just the best strategic fit. And I knew the CEO, Clay Collins. We kind of ran in overlapping circles. He was in like the internet marketing space and I was in the more of the startup space, but we overlapped a bit. He had been on my podcast and stuff. So it wasn't just like, oh, we have these five suitors and we're going to pick LeadPages. It was kind of like, well, let's kind of follow each of these tracks, you know, and they didn't all happen at once, right? It was over the course of like maybe 18 months that like these five conversations happened. And so we just kind of followed each of them to their logical extent. And the one that, you know, made the most sense and just kept coming back up, you know, again and again, because deals fall apart like this, right? Because someone puts a number on a piece of paper and you're just like, yeah, that's nowhere close. And then it's like, all right, well, then we're out, you know? And then 2 months later you get an email and it's like, hey, so we want to rekindle. I mean, that's how these things go, right? So it took 13 months from the first email when Clay reached out to when the deal closed. And it was really about 6 months of hard negotiation during that.
Sure. Yeah. And that walking away, right? That that's so typical on a lot of these deals, especially in a strategic deal, being able to walk away. Yeah. And, you know, people's goals and objectives change over that time as well. So they can reevaluate things. What were some of the things that you learned going from, you know, a complete startup environment, you know, where you're a super agile, small team, but you're building and, you know, that kind of hang on to the seat of your pants sort of growth, and then being absorbed by a company that had raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars and much different sort of environment. What sort of transition was that?
The transition was probably one of the best that I've heard about. Clay did a really good job of kind of leaving us alone for 3 to 4 months because we were all shell-shocked. It was so crazy. I mean, we moved here and then go into this big office, and there's people everywhere. And it was just this culture shock for us. So they made it as good as it could have been, I think. You know, they didn't screw with the product. Nobody said, let's change the roadmap. None of our, you know, all of our people came on board and joined the team. So I feel like the transition went as good as it could have, but it was still hard on me and hard on some of the team members because we had just been this tiny little team, you know, and then you get kind of absorbed into a 170 person company. But I mean, to Clay's credit, he set it up really well. I learned a bunch of stuff. The interesting transition, there was a mental transition at a certain point, is we've gone from basically being kind of cash strapped to having, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the bank, as you said, from the funding they raised. And I just realized we had to think about things totally differently. Like I needed to stop, you know, every week checking our AWS bill and trying to turn servers off and adjust things on the weekend. It's like that was no longer it was not worth saving $500 a month for all that time, you know, and you have to be cognizant of the money, but it's like $500 a month is just a rounding error. You know, they probably spend that on toilet paper in a month. And it's like, focus on, if I'm going to spend that mental bandwidth, do it on something that grows the bottom line or that improves the product. You know, it was things like that. And when we could finally pay everybody market rate salaries, it was so, so cool. We had to hire a lot of junior people and trained them up. We were growing drip. So it took us a while for people to really hit the ground running. And once we got here and it's like, oh man, we can pay market rate. We're able to hire senior engineers for the first time ever. And that was another game changer of like the luxury of having someone come in and like commit code 3 days into their job because the code base is solid and they are super advanced. You know, they've been doing it for 7 years instead of 6 months, you know, like some of the folks that who are great developers now, but they were just very junior when we hired them.
You have a lot of other projects, you know, besides Drip, obviously, over the years. You've had Startups for the Rest of Us. You've had MicroConf. They were totally cool with you just continuing on with those projects?
Yeah, that was the nice part is, you know, as Clay and I talked through the whole acquisition, it was like, I was like, Clay, here are my deal breakers. Number one, I'm not going to fire anybody. Like, I do not want to lay people off. And we didn't. Number two, I do not want to screw our customers. Like, please don't pivot us into some crazy niche, leave the customers behind that we already have, shut the product down. You know, like, let's not do damage to that. And I can't remember my own deal breakers. I had like a price. I said it kind of needs to be for enough money that I never have to work again. Like, that was one of my things. And so we figured all that out. That was the third one is I was like, look, I do MicroConf and he knew that. And I do the podcast and I don't spend that much time on them in all honesty. Like, the podcast is about 30, 40 minutes a week. And, MicroConf typically was off hours and it might be 20 hours, you know, aside from when I would go there, it was like 20 hours of prep work. We had a coordinator doing it. So it was just something up front. He's like, yeah, that's good. And I said, and when I do a lot of public speaking too. I said, you know, I'll be representing Drip and LeadPages at that point. Right. So it's actually perhaps of benefit to the company. So it was good. That would have been a really, I was going to say it'd be tough, but that would have been a deal breaker. I don't think I would have not done the podcast or the conferences. It's just something I've done forever, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk about MicroConf real quick. For people that don't know, what is MicroConf?
Yeah. MicroConf is a conference that's run twice a year. In Las Vegas and then in Europe. And it is a conference for self-funded startups, so bootstrap startups. And we're not anti-funding, and it doesn't mean that companies who raise funding, you know, can't come, because there's certainly a lot of 80% of what funded and unfunded companies worry about is the same thing. It's hiring and it's marketing and it's building a good product. And then there's this 20% that we just don't talk much about at MicroConf. And so we have a growth edition, which is for businesses that are providing a full-time income or more. So it's a lot of 6, 7 and some 8-figure businesses, but it's definitely smaller. It's SaaS focused, but we do get e-commerce people. We do get WordPress plugins, you know, and info marketers and stuff. And that conference, the growth one's about 250 people, and it sells out every year. And then we have the starter edition, which is, you know, from idea to full-time income. And that's at the same time. Right around the same time in Vegas. And then we have, of course, the Europe edition, which is here in a few months in Croatia. It's in October. And I'm excited to go to Croatia. And we started selling tickets for that a couple of weeks ago. So we try to get, you know, we wanted to build a conference that we wanted to attend. Like Mike and I, who's my co-host with the conference, it was like, I go to these conferences and there's multi-tracks and there's the vendor halls and there's all this bullshit. I really just want to come. I want to meet entrepreneurs. I want the attendees to be top notch, right? I don't want it to be the marketing guy, the C-level guy from this Oracle, or it's like that. No, that doesn't help me. You know, I want the attendees to almost all be entrepreneurs in a similar space. And then we want to keep it small. They tend to be about 120 to 250 attendees. And then we want to get really good speakers that may not, these are not like the big name speaker who comes up and pumps you up. And, you know, there's time and place for that, but it's super, super tactical. And so that's what it's kind of like, if you want tactics and some inspiration, come to our conference. If you want just pure inspiration and you just want to get pumped up, then go, you know, go see Tony Robbins or go to the World Domination Summit. It's just a very, very different thing. So that's my spiel on it. It's microconf.com if folks are interested.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely love those smaller conferences, the 100 to 150 attendees, you know, 200 attendees, but where it's really focused again on the people that you get to know. From those conferences, I just find that you do get to know people so much better, and the partnerships and relationships that come out of that more than pay for any sort of price that you're going to have to pay. And your locations, Croatia?
Yeah,
are you kidding? That's incredible.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah, I'm stoked. We did it in Barcelona. We did it in Prague for 2 years, Barcelona for 2 years, and then we did it in Lisbon, Portugal last year, and this year we're up in the game. It's going to be a little hard to get to, but man, we're stoked because I've never been to Croatia. We do try to like put it in places that people would want to go to, but that we want to go to as well. You know, it's an excuse to visit a cool country.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We're up against the clock here, but what does the future hold for you? You left Drip a few months ago. What are you looking at doing here in the future?
I don't know yet. I started writing a book about my experience. So I've written a couple books about software startups and that kind of stuff. And I started writing another one, and then I got about 12,000 words in, and I was just like, you know, I don't know that I want to do this right now. It was all about my experience with Drip and everything. And it was funny. I just kind of petered out. So I don't know if I'll come back to that. I don't have a deep desire to do anything bigger than Drip. I think I'm going to take another few months off, and I know something will come up. I'm probably going to acquire something is what's going to happen. And, but I want to do something that like, it needs to make money for my personality, you know, like I have to, that's how we all keep score. Right. But I kind of want to do something in like, even in a hobby space that I really enjoy. Like I can't imagine going back into doing another SaaS app. You know, it's just, I've been there, I've done that. What's new? Like, could it be a just a completely different thing that I really enjoy that also makes some money, but maybe it's not some big fancy startup that gets acquired.
Well, awesome. Well, good luck with all of that. And let's make sure that we stay in touch, especially being local to each other here, but let's make sure that we stay in touch. Thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.